Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome to our second hour on Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. It's a real pleasure for us to have a call to Indianapolis, Indiana, my hometown. Rod Kelsey, how are you today?
I'm very well, Zara. Thank you for having me on.
Bad. In a special segment we're calling Crossroads, Choosing Cooperation. So let me introduce Rod. He's based in India, as I mentioned, and he's executive director of the Mid-America Cooperative Council, which is a nonprofit association of cooperatives across the four-state area of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. Mid-America focuses on education and outreach programs, and under Rod's leadership since 2004, has had over 3,300 attendees at some 100-plus events in these past 5 years. Rod grew up on a farm in north central Indiana, and he's graduated from Purdue University, also my alma mater, with a bachelor's in ag education and ag economics. And after 5 years in sales and marketing, veterinary and pharmaceuticals for Elanco, which is a division of Eli Lilly, Rod attended University of Illinois, receiving a master's in ag economics with a finance concentration. He then returned to his family's farm for 3 years before dedicating the next 20 to strategic planning for cooperatives and private companies, as well as 6 years as an independent consultant in board and strategic planning. A recipient of the prestigious Sagamore of the Wabash Award, which is the highest distinction a citizen in the state of Indiana can receive from the governor, Rod is a respected educator and advocate for businesses at a crossroad, using cooperation as a way to get to that next level. So, Rod, I think probably a first place we should start is, what is the cooperative business model? Some of our listeners might not be familiar with it.
Well, the cooperative business model has been around for many thousands of years. It's essentially when two people get together, have a common need, that need can be solved better together by them combining their efforts and serving their own unique need. For example, if two people go into a grocery store and they find that there's a sale that you can get 12 oranges for less money than just purchasing six, two people can go together and form that need.
And in fact, that is the premise then of food cooperatives, right? That larger bulk buying can be done for those that are members, and then they parcel it up across the group.
That is actually the consumer co-op is actually one of the largest groups of co-ops that we have in our society today, because a group of consumers, community, if you will, or a neighborhood will decide that they want to purchase certain products, food products that the local grocery store just cannot offer themselves. So they create their own marketplace, and they go out and they purchase those products and they distribute those products themselves. Cooperatives there was a study done a couple of years ago, and there were 30,000 cooperatives in the United States. And the majority of those co-ops are actually consumer co-ops, with food co-ops, rural electric co-ops, and credit unions being the lion's share of that particular marketplace.
Okay, so the idea that a credit union is truly a cooperative.
That's correct, where a group of people can pool their money, lend it back out to local businesses, local individuals for homes and car loans, and then the profits from those proceedings, or from the interest rates on those loans, any profits then are revolved back in lower interest rates. Believe it or not, Zara, there are actual credit union and farm credit system loans out there that after you've had maybe a 7% loan on your house for 5 or 6 years, that the credit union or the farm credit services will come back and say, you know, we think that 7% interest is too high. We're going to lower that automatically to 5%, and it's not cost you anything.
And in fact, that's why I think if you look at credit unions, they call their participants members as opposed to customers.
Exactly. They're member owners.
Member owners, that's right.
That's right. There are a few other unique businesses that are out there. Vanguard, a large investment firm on the New York Stock Exchange, is essentially a cooperative. Any business that has mutual in its name is a cooperative. So It's been a large group, particularly for farmers or those individuals who find themselves with an inefficient marketplace to sell their products to, particularly when they have time-sensitive product, like a producer that has grapefruits or oranges or milk that is perishable, and they want to get that product to the marketplace as quick as possible.
So that they form a cooperative then that can then leverage common marketing and distribution channels to get it faster, is that what it is?
Exactly. Plus, then a larger group of farmers, you, your neighbor, and everybody else can come together and market to the marketplace and have a stronger marketing power than an individual trying to market food products to the marketplace by themselves. And particularly now that we have four or five large retailers that represent half of all the food that's marketed to our citizens here in the United States, it's important to realize that having that competitive market balance to be able to go with the marketplace with some equivalent market power is important.
Well, and I think the other piece of it, you'd also couldn't help but think about Hardin in this day and age with the whole propensity for outsourcing and moving things offshore, that the idea of the power of the local to lean upon one another and keep some of this, at least in your community.
We actually have examples where in Puerto Rico, for example, there was a Dexter shoe manufacturing company that realized instead of paying their employees, you know, $8 an hour, they could go to Malaysia and pay their employees 80 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So the employees of that Dexter shoe manufacturing plant said, well, why don't we buy the plant? We will produce the shoes. And we will then profit. If there are profits at the end of the year, we will share in those particular profits. And today, but that particular shoe plant is the major provider of shoes for the U.S. Postal Service.
So they, at the same time, then were able to scale up and get a partner that would still, though, allow them to keep their costs in line, because that still is a competing factor.
Right. One of the things I want to make clear is the cooperative is still a business.
Right.
Still a business model. It still operates in the marketplace. It still pays taxes, although it doesn't pay the double corporate taxes. It does pay taxes on its earnings, and the member owners, those who use the co-op's services, who receive the benefits of the products, and who receive whatever profits or after capital expenses are necessary to take place, then end up paying for that patronage that's returned back to them at the end of the year.
So is it fair to say that, Rod, one of the challenges out there in this day and age where cooperatives might come under attack would be because they do not pay the double corporate taxes?
Absolutely. Credit unions, for example, have about 7% of the total financial services marketplace. So it's a fairly small percentage, but yet every year the private banking community is desperate to try to knock out the credit union. There's an actual case in the 1920s of a group of women in New England who were women of means who had financial assets, and the local banking community desperately courted them because they wanted them to keep their money in their local banks. And these women said, you know, we will probably not get a voice on the board of directors because this is before women's suffrage took place and women could even vote at that time. And we know we have neighbors and friends who would like to borrow money from us, that want to open dress shops, that want to open other businesses that cater to women or cater to the needs of our local community. We're going to create a credit union on our own, and we're going to lend that money to those women, let them start their shops and their businesses, and then any profits that are left over will continue to serve other women's needs. And it's been a very successful credit union over time.
Isn't that interesting? Well, Rod, you know, you said at the opening that credit unions have been around for a long time. In fact, I think some of the data you gave me showed that the very first one was started by Benjamin Franklin.
The very first co-op in the United States began by Benjamin Franklin, and it was actually an insurance co-op.
Mm-hmm.
There had been a fire that came through Philadelphia, and he essentially surmised that if a large community together can put a small bit of money away, then when a fire happens, then we can have some money there to help those individuals rebuild. So it's the concept of a large group supporting individuals who have experienced severe loss that's very haphazard or very, you know, like a fire or a tornado.
Great, very good. Again, for our listeners who may have just turned in, I have Rod Kelsey with me. He's Executive Director of Mid-America Cooperative Council. We are live. If anyone would like to call in, it's 520-751-1041 or toll-free. It's 877-544-2580. Rod, you know, your various principles of cooperatives, I think we've touched on several of them, the fact that they're voluntary and there's open membership, right? There isn't the discretion.
Correct.
Democratic member control. So the governance of these organizations then is unique, right? This is part of the unique model.
And that's exactly what our association spends so much time working on. The membership, and again, it's those who use the co-op own the co-op. So it's those who come in and use the co-op services. Basically, they elect their board of directors with a one-man, one vote, just like our democratic process. Then those board members then govern, hire a manager, or govern the bylaws of a community. Co-ops don't have to be complex. Many common co-ops are babysitting co-ops. In fact, your friend and my wife, Jeannie, became a member of a small babysitting co-op when 25 stay-at-home moms in her neighborhood were aware that they could pass their bank hours with the co-op, so that when they wanted to go shopping or wanted an afternoon off, then they could have their children being taken care of by other mothers in the neighborhood. And then when those mothers needed to go do something or needed a requirement, then they banked their hours back with my wife. And it's a very informal way of serving the individual needs.
Interesting. So, Rod, your own career, having been a farmer for years and then stepping in and studying, you know, agriculture, economics, and finance, was it always thus on the forefront of your mind, understanding the vitality and necessity of the cooperative model, or is it something that you kind of eased into over time?
Well, I would say it's something that's been in the back of my mind for a long period of time. Both my mother and my father served on boards of directors of cooperatives, so they would go to the meeting essentially representing their neighbors. But unlike our representatives in Washington, D.C., they wanted to try to represent all of the what is good for all of the members and not just for those that were their specific neighbors or they themselves. Mm-hmm. So there are some individual challenges in our cooperative model that sometimes go against the culture of our time. So I remember my mom and dad coming home from their board meetings and they're just scratching their head and really not understanding their duty or responsibility or how they could really help. So that gives me a lot of extra enthusiasm and interest to go out and do my director education programs, of which we've had over 1,000 directors through to help board members of cooperatives really understand their role and responsibility.
So take us there. So what does the governance board, how are the governance boards different then from a cooperative and the kind of consulting and coaching you've done over your years, a private board of directors vis-a-vis those who are involved in the governance of a cooperative?
Well, they're in some ways, it's first of all very similar to any investor-owned business. First of all, it's a business; it must be run profitably. It must serve the benefit of the customers. It must do so legally, ethically. It's going to, you know, pay taxes on earnings mm-hmm. that they make. It's got to be competitive in the marketplace. Cooperatives are not philanthropic, although technically cooperatives are nonprofit. And that's because since the co-ops are owned by the members, essentially that co-op is an extension of that
right.
member's either business or farming operation or personal need, so that when they're buying and selling product, it's essentially like you're making those transactions yourself. So in the governance standpoint, they first of all want to make sure that it's an efficient operation and run very well. The challenge then becomes, what happens if you have made some money and you have an investment in your credit union or investment in your ag supply co-op, and you at the end of the year you want that investment revolved back out. For example, at the end of the year, if there's a co-op has, let's just take for example, has $1,000 in profit. It has 10 members. Those 10 members probably didn't use that co-op the same amount. Maybe one member did half of the total business of the co-op. The other nine members did the other half of the co-op. So the patronage or the profits then go back based on use, not on ownership, which is uniquely different than our investor-owned company. So the person who did half of the business with the co-op then would get half of those profits. Now, the other unique part about a co-op is those the patronage that goes back at the end of the year does not have to go back all as cash. Some of it can go back as stock or equity credits.
Uh-huh.
So 50% of that, it's very common, or 30% of that, the co-op member will get a check for, and the other 70% he'll get an equity credit for that will be redeemed at a point later in time.
So you can see where the tracking mechanisms and metrics and all that really needs to be very transparent to kind of keep the peace, you know, of what you want to say and make sure the goals are clear for everyone. So that governance model is different than paying a shareholder dividend, you know, for people that own stock.
Right, and it's that transparency. There are several what we call structural faults within the co-op system. So if I'm one of those members, if there's 10 members of the co-op in our little example here, maybe there are only five that are on the board of directors. Well, if I'm not on the board of directors, then my perception is those that are on the board of directors are getting special deals that I am not getting. Or the person who does half the business is getting a very special deal. Now, from a transparency standpoint, co-ops and the communication from co-ops back to their membership is very important. And we really haven't ran into the kind of problems and governance challenges because managers and member boards of directors and even the member owners want to know, how is my co-op doing? So they're in there talking, they're asking questions, they're learning more about the business. Are they really serving my needs, and are they looking out in the future so that we can serve needs in the future?
Wonderful. So, Rod, the type of education and training programs then that MidAmerica Cooperative Council gets involved in, and you obviously are touching a lot of different types of co-ops. I know you and I spoke before the show here today, and you just came off a real high of working with a group of young people who are actually interning with these different cooperatives. That must be a great early business experience for them.
It's really funny when you sit in a room of people and they start telling you their birth date, and it's 1989.
Don't go there, please.
1990, and they, you know, and we're talking, trying to explain to them this unique co-op model, which in theory is very simple. You know, it's a group of people trying to serve a need that's kind of broken in the marketplace, but it's a bootstrapped up self-service where we can do this ourselves. We don't need anybody else. We don't need a large benefactor to come in. If we all pool what little resources we have, we can serve this need by creating our own cooperative. And these students very early on understand that from a general standpoint, but then when we get into how do you revolve the profits back, or how do you make sure that the ownership and the control piece, and again, even though we're a nonprofit, we're not a charity.
Mm-hmm.
In charities, the owners have no rights or claims on the assets, whereas in a cooperative, those assets are the member owners' assets.
And but I could see those eyes. I can well imagine the wheels that must have been turning for those young people as there's, you know, you get this idea in your head about the entrepreneurship movement within the country and youth in particular, because they don't know what they don't know, which is great.
Exactly.
And so the innovation, and so to be exposed to this different business model is really profound.
Well, the other part is these young people really want to make a profound impact as soon as possible for their employer. They really want to show that they're worthy of being an employee of that particular company. And we gave them the challenge at this time to do a communications audit of their particular cooperative, and in that communications audit, find out how they communicate between generations, because we've got sometimes four different generations working for the same co-op. The member owners that are part of this co-op, sometimes four different generations. So the whole way of making communication between people is different. And we asked them to give us suggestions on how we can communicate better.
Well, Rod, when you speak of the agrarian portions of your co-op too, you know, the whether it be milk, grain, organic foods and the like, and the farms, I think in same in your situation, you're also talking about family-run businesses, right? So you've got that that double nuance or additional perspective of family-owned businesses, too.
That's right. That these family-owned businesses, in fact, I oftentimes explain that a co-op is much like a family because we want to make sure that everybody's need is served. Mm-hmm. Now, we serve that need equitably and in a business fashion, but we don't, I mean, for example, in our ag supply co-ops, we go out with different prices based on what the cost of services are for providing those products or services. But we're not like an investor-owned company who oftentimes has a different price for every customer out there, and it becomes very dynamic. One of the largest growing areas of our cooperatives are retirement communities.
Ooh, talk to us about that. That sounds interesting.
When people get ready to retire, they want to still have a stake in the game. They want to still feel like that they have some control over where they live. And there is a wonderful cooperatively managed retirement community in Minnesota that's kind of become a model for that. And the average age there is 85.
Average age is 85.
And the reason they say, one of the joke among those who live there, I think there's over 700
units. Yeah. Oh, 700 units, okay.
700 units there. And one of the joke is that almost everybody is on a committee of some kind. Since they own the governance, they own it, they all have their input on how the gardens are managed or where the recreation is or how the parties are planned.
And I bet you anything, someone will step back and do a study on that and realize that's why the average age is so old, is these people are very active and engaged in their community.
Precisely, Zara, right. Because they say, I can't die. I've got a committee meeting tomorrow, and I've got people that are counting on me to make sure we've got the gardens planned just the way the community wants them, not what the management wants, but what our owners that are living in this retirement community want.
Well, and I think, you know, you referenced earlier these young kids that are coming to your programs. Then you have my generation of the baby boomers that we're kind of trying to get touched in with those roots, because come truly the later in life experience for us, that the last thing we want to be is a burden on society. But the sheer numbers could indicate that with healthcare, what it is, and so on and so forth. So what a beautiful experience to see that Minnesota co-op then.
One other point I want to bring up is this coming week, we have our ACE conference, and ACE is the Association of Cooperative Educators. We've got about 150 members. About two-thirds are here in the United States, and one-third are here between Canada and the Caribbean, the Puerto Rico area. And we're going to Cleveland, and one of the reasons we're going to Cleveland is because of the Evergreen Co-op movement. And there, the Cleveland Foundation and the Cleveland Clinic have set up a project to try to encourage an employee-owned laundry co-op in what they call their university circle.
Mm-hmm.
In the near eastern side of Cleveland, there is a large center there where the Cleveland Clinic is, Case Western Reserve is, and they call it their university circle, where literally they have world-class health care services. And I don't know, many hundreds of thousands of pounds of linens and laundry are generated every week. Well, currently that laundry is being moved, and we have the cost of moving that 60, 70, 100 miles outside of the city for laundry services and then move back. The crying shame is that if you take a mile donut around that particular world-class institution, the average household income is less than $20,000.
Okay.
So you've got a very high poverty level there, and it's people that really haven't been given a chance to. So what the movement is to create a self-sustaining, high-efficient laundry co-op where these employees can be hired from this community, and the money can stay there in their community. They can take ownership of this new laundry service, and they can have their own equity investment in that employee-owned business model of an employee-owned laundry co-op. And then they are currently sacrificing now a little bit so that they can buy their shares and build their equity stake, so that down the road their children will have an opportunity to work in a laundry business that can serve the needs of the cooperative community that they have started.
That's a fabulous model, an interesting way. Well, Rod Kelsey from the Mid-America Cooperative Council, thank you so much for joining us here on Circles of Change, and wish you the best in your leadership endeavors and making a mark that you are through others.
Thank you, Tara.
Great, very good. Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.